Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. The Koala Moon podcast has revolutionized over 20 million bedtimes, with parents like you calling it life-changing and the perfect nighttime routine. With original kids' bedtime stories and cozy sleep meditations, every episode has been specially designed to make bedtimes a dream. Listen to Koala Moon on the iHeartRadio app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Discover a new educational and interactive podcast, Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids. Our episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We went shape hunting around the block, and we found spheres and cubes on the street.
That was great fun. Join Stories for Kids, the Lingo Kids podcast, inspiring you to learn while having fun. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
As the number one audio company, iHeartMedia gives you access to all. Every audience, live conversations, trusted influencers, and the insights and data you need to grow. iHeartMedia is your access company. Go to iHeartResults.com for more.
Hi, I'm Ethan Nadelman, and this is Psychoactive, a production of iHeartRadio and Protozoa Pictures. Psychoactive is the show where we talk about all things drugs. But any views expressed here do not represent those of iHeartMedia, Protozoa Pictures, or their executives and employees. Indeed, as an inveterate contrarian, I can tell you they may not even represent my own. And nothing contained in this show should be used as medical advice or encouragement to use any type of drug. Hello, Psychoactive listeners. So today we're going to venture into a territory which I rarely or ever enter into, which is the neuroscience of drugs. You know, I'm always drawn to the history, the culture, the politics, what have you, the therapeutic side. But it's important to try to get a sense of why some drugs work the way they do. And in this case, we're going to focus on why MDMA and psychedelics seem to have this remarkable therapeutic potential, which is kind of sort of what's behind this psychedelic renaissance. The person I've asked to join me today to talk about this is Professor Gul Dolan. She's in the Department of Neuroscience at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. She's been doing research on psychedelics in recent years, but she's got a much longer background going to doing research on oxytocin and trying to understand autism better. She got her MD and her PhD at Brown and MIT. She did a postdoc training at Stanford. She's been publishing important articles for a good 15 years, but has really started to generate some incredible excitement in recent years because of a few studies that she's done that seem to provide some new insights into how and why MDMA and to some extent psychedelics work the way they do. One of them involves octopuses, and another is studies done on mice, but with important implications for understanding why MDMA works the way it does and other psychedelics with human beings. So, Gul, thanks ever so much for joining me on Psychoactive.
Thank you very much for having me.
So let me just start off the first most basic question. We now have these studies. And by the way, I'm going to sometimes say MDMA and psychedelics. Sometimes I'll say MDMA and other psychedelics because MDMA isn't quite a psychedelic. So if I go back and forth, just I hope our listeners will give me a little forgiveness there. But the first question is, we know there's been studies, you know, you do studies on animals at the beginning to show the safety of a drug, to make sure that MDMA or something's not toxic. But just the very basic question, if we already have a good sense that these drugs are having an impact on humans, say in a therapeutic context and for therapeutic value, why even bother with studies on other animals?
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's actually something I've debated a little bit with people who are very invested in, you know, pursuing the clinical trials. They cost a lot more money. So why do we need the mechanism? And the reason is because, you know, while many of these drugs have been used in traditional healing practices for years and years and years, centuries, we are using them differently. Necessarily, we're using them differently because we are embedding these practices in a different culture and we are trying to treat people who are raised in a different culture. And so if we're going to try and adapt them for use the way that we want to use them, we really need to have a strong basis in understanding what they're doing, why they're working, so that we can use them appropriately, so that we don't inadvertently cause harm when we're trying to apply them in new ways, so that we understand both the limitations, the constraints, and the opportunities that work in our context. And I will just back up and say one more thing, which is that I think that because of the way science gets reported in our newspapers and in the lay press, you know, there's this impression that we understand a lot of things from doing studies in humans exclusively. But almost all of the mechanisms that we understand because we've been able to do very basic studies in animal models, right? So, you know, you mentioned my interest in oxytocin. Almost everything we know about oxytocin, its involvement in regulating love and its involvement at regulating neurotransmitters and the connections between neurons and how signals get transmitted between those brain cells. All of those studies were done in animals. And then we extrapolated from those to humans based on similarities that we know exist between mice and human brains.
Mm-hmm. Oxytocin, that's the drug that's kind of known as the love drug or the hug drug, the one that gets released when a mother nurses her baby or when people make love or things like that, right?
That's right. That's right. And the other drug that everybody talks about is serotonin, the neurochemical that people have implicated in mood and depression, and that all of these drugs like Prozac that are selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors or SSRIs, these molecules, everything we know about them because of animal studies that we've then extrapolated to humans.
I see. So now when we think about animal studies, typically, you know, we think about mice or rats, or maybe you might think about things like, you know, primates, apes, orangutans, or maybe even dolphins, you know, things that are known for high intelligence and are sort of closer to us. But you decided to work with octopuses and to administer MDMA to octopuses. Why octopuses?
Yeah. So basically, I mean, I think it's a very strong tradition in science to try and understand human emotion and cognition and disease by focusing on the closest relative that we can do these kinds of experiments in. And then that way, we presume that we will be able to understand some sort of rules. And because they're closely related, it's easier to make that extrapolation. But the approach that we decided to take was one that had kind of been in the scientific literature for a while. It was actually proposed by J.Z. Young, who's a really important physiologist and ethologist in neuroscience and behavioral studies of animals. And he said, what you really want to do is to go for the animal that is evolutionarily most distant from us. So most different, separated by as much evolutionary time as you can, who also exhibits some of the complex behaviors that we do. And then by comparing those maximally different brains to each other, then you can sort of overlook or look past all the extraneous historical accidents of evolution and figure out the rules for how to build complexity. And so we decided that we wanted to understand how serotonin, this neurotransmitter that I mentioned, has been implicated in almost every function you can think of, including mood and feeding and temperature regulation. And we wanted to know, how old is its role in regulating social behaviors? And can we deduce any of those rules by looking at an octopus?
Mm-hmm. And so basically, I mean, if I understand it, so an octopus is quite radically different than human beings. They don't have the same kind of brain, all the things that the parts of the brain that supposedly light up when you do MDMA, they don't even have that. So the common element is that they have these serotonin transporters. Is that the key thing that makes it relevant here?
Yeah. So that was actually the idea we were testing. Their brains don't look anything like our brains. Their brains actually look much more like a snail's brain because they are mollusks, and they don't have the same sort of organization of centralizing all the brain functions into one. They have a central brain, but they also have distributed brains controlling each of their arms. And so in the absence of all of the brain regions that we think of as being important for social behaviors or cognition, that they were able to respond to the MDMA in pretty similar ways to the ways that mice and rats and humans respond to MDMA. In other words, when we measured their pro-social behavior, their desire to spend time in the chamber that had the other octopus in it increased after we gave them MDMA. That told us that all of the anatomical things that we're used to attributing the functions of these drugs to really are sort of extraneous detail, and that they're just accidents of the evolutionary history of that animal. And that the thing that really matters for encoding this social function of serotonin is at the level of molecules, and specifically the proteins that encode the serotonin transporter, which MDMA binds to. And that just by having that, it's enough to override the normal behavior that we see in octopuses, which is, you know, they're not social. In fact, if you put two octopuses in this species in particular, if you put them in a tank together, they will kill each other. And so MDMA has this very powerful ability to override that and make them desire social interaction and spend more time with the other animal.
I have to tell you, Gul, I mean, until like a couple of days ago when I started prepping for our conversation, almost everything I knew about octopuses was from seeing that Academy Award winning documentary by the South African fellow Craig Foster, My Octopus Teacher, which I loved. It talks about the sort of wariness and asociability of octopus, but obviously there's this bonding that goes on there between them. Although some people have said maybe we're just anthropomorphizing, you know, attributing to the octopus human characteristics and behavior more than is appropriate. But it was, I don't know. I mean, as I'm reading your study, I just kept thinking about that. Have you seen that film?
I have seen it. It was a beautifully shot film, but I agree with the concern that we're anthropomorphizing. And I'll just put it out there that Aristotle actually thought that octopuses were the stupidest animal. And that was because back in his time, you know, they were abundant in the sea and they were sort of easy to catch because all you had to do is put a rod in front of them and they would, out of this intense sense of curiosity, reach out and grab the rod. And then you just pull the rod up and the octopus would come with it. So, you know, people have been studying octopuses for thousands of years. And depending on your perspective, whether you consider them an easy to catch food source or whether you are making a Netflix documentary about them, the tendency to anthropomorphize can lead you to very different conclusions about what they're capable of. And so one thing I would say is that even though we characterize them as being asocial most of the time, in fact, they do suspend that asociality during brief times that are important for their behavior. So the species that we were studying in the MDMA paper was Octopus bimaculoides, or the California two-spot octopus. And that octopus will suspend this sort of aggressive stance that they take to other members of their species when they are mating. We know that they must have the circuitry for social behavior somewhere in their brains, and that for whatever reason that we haven't really understood, evolutionary selection pressures have made it so that it's more beneficial to whatever strategy they're using to mostly be asocial and turn off that sociality, except when they're going to be mating.
Yeah. Yeah. When I was reading up about octopuses before talking with you, I mean, I saw that not all octopuses are asocial. As you just pointed out, like there's something called the larger Pacific striped octopus, which is a little more social. And so the element of there being a bit of loners, right, was kind of relevant to the research because you're looking at the sociability associated with MDMA?
That's right. Well, I mean, honestly, we didn't know what was going to happen. We started the experiment thinking, you know, maybe what's going to happen is that serotonin is old or the transmitter and the transporter is there, but when we give the MDMA, it's just going to induce sort of a hyperactive behavior or something similar to what amphetamines might do to the brain of a mammal, because it's in the amphetamine class and serotonin. We didn't know if this pro-social function was as old as some of its other functions. And we didn't know if it could bind to it, if it was going to also bind to other transporters and do other things. So we wanted to start with this social because that was the question that we were interested in, but also octopuses, because they're so asocial. When we just did the baseline measurements of how much time they spend in the social chamber versus the chamber that had a little toy object in it, they spent almost all of their time in the toy object chamber, which was maximally distant from the other octopus. And so that made a really nice baseline measurement. And so when we gave them MDMA and the behavior shifted 180 degrees, and now they spent most of their time in the social chamber, we didn't need very many animals to be able to statistically draw the conclusion that, you know, the MDMA had this effect on changing their social behavior.
Yeah. So, Ghoul, when it comes to administering MDMA or other drugs to the mice or other animals, how do you do it? Is it injection or another means? And how do you figure out the right dosing levels and what's comparable to levels in humans?
Yeah, so with the mice, it's sort of straightforward. We just give them an injection, what we call an IP injection, intraperitoneal injection, and we're just injecting it directly into their abdomen. And because most of these psychedelics are very blood-brain barrier permeable, it gets into the brain. And we test the doses to make sure that we start with the human dose and adjust it for weight. And we just kind of titrate until we see the effect. And remarkably, the effects seem to be pretty close. The dose that we would use in a human is usually within 10 times of what we see in a mouse, 10 times more, 10 times less, or the same. And so that was reassuring. That can change because mouse metabolism is very fast. So you have to be careful about that. So we want to test it every time. The trickier one was definitely the octopus because we didn't know how to deliver it. The octopus is a sea creature. And so the way that it receives drugs normally, the equivalent would be if we put it in the water, is on their gills and it's sort of washing over their gills and getting into the blood directly from the gills. And so putting MDMA in the water might be something like figuring out a way of making aerosolized MDMA and then putting somebody in a hot box with aerosolized MDMA for 30 minutes. So we really weren't sure, but we decided to go ahead and try it anyway. And this is true with all experiments that we do in octopus. We never want to just assume that it's the same because their physiology is so different. They don't have a liver. They have something between a liver and a pancreas. Those cells have some of the features of both. It's not clear that they have a blood-brain barrier. They don't even metabolize oxygen in the same way that we do. So we had to test it and we just titrated. We start high and then work our way backwards until we got to the right dose.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So Ghoul, when you're testing animals given psychedelics, is it getting the permission from the university or from the funding agencies? Is it any different than giving animals other types of drugs?
Yeah, we have to go through all of the regulatory requirements for being approved for giving Schedule I medicines. And so that's a regulatory process that we have to do at both the federal and the state level. It took us about a year to get all of those licenses approved. And then once we get the licenses, then we have to go back to our Animal Care and Use Committee and work with them back and forth to make sure that we have done all the appropriate safeguarding measurements and that we're really making sure that we are doing these experiments in the safest and least stressful way for the animals. The octopus is sort of a unique situation because currently in the United States, octopuses have the same regulatory requirements as all other invertebrates. So flies and worms and cockroaches and all the invertebrates, right? But we are sensitive to the fact that octopuses, their behavioral repertoire is much more complex. And we certainly don't agree with Aristotle that they're the dumbest animals. So we have taken care to apply all the same standards that we use for mouse studies for the octopus to make sure that we're treating them in a way that respects their intelligence and their ability to feel pain and take good care of them.
We'll be talking more after we hear this ad.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. I'm Abby, a mother of two, and I had these battles myself. Endless excuses, delay tactics, and many tears and tantrums. But I've created a solution. The perfect kids podcast that makes bedtime a dream. It's called Koala Moon, and it's hosted by me, Abby. With over 300 episodes, packed with original stories and sleep meditations, Koala Moon makes bedtimes easy and enjoyable. Episodes start out engaging and really rather magical, but as they progress, they gently slow to a calm and relaxing pace to have your little ones out like a light. Since launching in 2022, Koala Moon has helped with over 20 million nights sleep and received over 6,000 five-star reviews. Win back your evenings. Listen to Koala Moon now on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What does optimism look like? I'm on a quest to find the people who inspire us to dream more and do more. I'm Simon Sinek, and I host a podcast called A Bit of Optimism. I talk to all sorts of people, from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to a hairdresser on Instagram who gives out free haircuts to the homeless, from the CEOs of the world's largest companies to the comedy writer who visited the wreckage of the Titanic. I love talking to leaders, artists, authors, and eccentrics about life, leadership, purpose, mental fitness, human skills, high performance, and other curious things. It leaves me feeling wiser, more inspired, and, well, more optimistic. Because after all, this is a bit of optimism. The world is full of magic and wonder, if you know where to look for it. Listen to A Bit of Optimism on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, ready to discover a new educational and interactive podcast for kids? Join Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids, where episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We learned how to recycle at the beach.
That was great fun. Cowie, what do you say?
It was. And that time when we did the science experiment and Billy made raisins dance.
That is so cool, Billy.
He did. Not to mention when a certain Elliot took up swimming classes with Lisa.
That was me.
Bet you can't catch me.
I'm going to get you.
All this fun and more in our Stories for Kids. Lingo Kids Stories for Kids is now available on Storybutton, the kid-friendly device for screenless podcast listening. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You know, the thing I was wondering in reading about your study was that I thought back to the famous Rat Park studies that Bruce Alexander did with, I think it was mice and cocaine. This is back in the 70s, I think. And this is a famous experiment where, you know, everybody knows this basic studies of you put mice or monkeys in a cage and you make available to them cocaine or a kind of saline solution alternative placebo thing. Many of them will just keep injecting or consuming the cocaine till they die. But what Bruce Alexander showed was that when you did the same experiment with animals that were in a kind of wild-like environment, In fact, they either had no interest in the cocaine, or if they did show any interest, they used it in a sort of moderation. It didn't fundamentally affect their lives. And it was all about the importance of setting, especially in terms of determining how people consume drugs, why they get into problematic relationships, all this sort of thing. I wondered if you'd been doing this study and somehow been able to do it with octopus who were in the wild, where they have to have a greater fear, presumably, about predators. Do you think you would have had a different result?
Well, it's a good question, and it's definitely something that we have thought a lot about. I mean, the rat part experiment, when I first started my lab back in 2014, that study had a big effect on me, because what it really made me realize is that when we started doing a lot of studies in rats especially, but mice also, for a number of practical, technical reasons, it was easier to keep isolation housing them. But rats and mice are both social animals. And so a lot of the conclusions we drew from some of those early drug addiction studies were probably wrong, because we were essentially studying animals who were enduring sort of social isolation stress and maybe more depressed, maybe more vulnerable to their drug environment because they weren't getting all of the social support that would be normal for their environment. Octopuses are sort of different than that. So octopuses in the wild are asocial. They prefer not to be living with other animals, except for, as you mentioned, the larger Pacific striped octopus, or LPSO, seems to be the only decidedly social octopus. But for the most part, octopuses prefer to live asocially. We had to design the experiment taking that into consideration, because we certainly didn't want to put them into a stressful situation by essentially allowing them to attack each other, which is why we kept the other octopus underneath a flower pot so that maybe they showed aggressive postures but couldn't actually hurt each other. And taking that into consideration, also didn't use a different assay that we use in mice that requires them to live together overnight, because we knew that they were asocial. So we always have to take those kinds of how do they live in the wild into consideration when we're trying to design experiments, and not accidentally retesting the stress effects of living in a way that they are not ethologically suited to live when we do the experiment.
Right, because presumably the asociability was an evolutionary thing that it developed, right, in terms of their survival. The ones that survive are the ones that are smarter, and maybe the ones that are more asocial.
I mean, you know, one thing that I find to be fascinating and kind of what keeps drawing me back to wanting to do more studies in octopus is that all of the other cephalopods are social, right? So Nautilus has a shell, that's true, but squid and cuttlefish don't have an external shell either, and yet they are very social. And so there's something separate about octopuses, maybe that because they're hunting for fish and they've taken on predatory behaviors that are similar to other top predators, and that they, for some reason, it's not advantageous to do pack hunting. We don't really know. And so this is why I'm so fascinated by the larger Pacific striped octopus, because somehow something's different. And that species of the 300 or so known species of octopus is the one that has evolved a social pattern of living. And it would be, I think, fascinating to know what was the selection pressure that pushed them to that type of living that's so different from all the rest.
But presumably it'd be harder to discern the impact of MDMA among creatures that have a higher level of sociability.
Well, so, I mean, that's actually a pretty good segue to talk about what MDMA does in mice, right?
Let's go there. Yeah.
So basically, we knew that MDMA already had acute prosocial effects in mice and in humans. And some of the work that supported that actually was from behavioral tests that are very similar to the one that we did in octopuses. So I'm just putting the animals in a large arena that's divided into three rooms and just measuring how much time they spend in each of the three rooms, one of which has another social animal and one of them that doesn't. And that was sort of looking at what happens when you're given the drug and the animal is experiencing the acute effects of the drug. So the altered state of consciousness plus this recreational users of MDMA are known for, you know, cuddle puddles and lots of pro-social hugging and wanting to be close to other people, right? And we see that same behavior in mice and in octopuses. But We were in my lab already studying another phenomenon. We were interested in the developmental regulation of social behaviors because we know that a person's way of being social changes over their lifetime, right? So teenagers are famously, they love to hang out with each other. They have, 300 friends. They're always on the phone. They just can't get enough of social interactions. But as you get older, you like to be social, but geez, sometimes you need some quality alone time to gather your thoughts and replenish your social resources, if you will. And so that change across development suggested to us that there must be something like a critical period for social behaviors. And we thought it was important to try and understand the neural mechanisms of that, because those changes in the way that we learn from our social environment probably have a big impact on things like peer pressure, and also probably impact why it is that when you have a social injury when you're very young, it has a much more devastating long-term consequence than if you have a social injury when you're old. Why we do things like we safeguard children, why we make sure that they're not exposed to violent television content, and why we sort of monitor to make sure that they are not receiving damaging information, social information when they're young. And so what my lab set out to do is to use a different assay. So now we're not just measuring the acute effects of social interactions. We're using an assay called social conditioned place preference, which is just animals being put in a chamber. And we just have two types of bedding on the floor. And we just take a baseline measurement just to make sure that they don't have some pre-existing bias for one of the two types of bedding. We just let them run around for 30 minutes on the two types of bedding, measure how much time they spend on each. And then we put them in a new chamber with one of the two types of bedding. And this time they're paired for 24 hours with their social group members. And then we put them for 24 hours on the other type of bedding, this time by themselves. And then we take another measurement asking how much time do they now, after they form this association between the bedding and the social environment, how much time do they spend in each of those two types of beddings? And by doing that, what we've discovered and other people have shown as well is that mice, especially juvenile mice, will form a long-lasting, strong, positive association between the bedding and a social environment, and a negative association to the bedding associated with being by themselves. And that ability to learn from their social environment, or the rewarding nature of that social environment, what we discovered is that as the animals get older, that goes away. And that attenuation, or that diminishment of the ability to learn from the social environment, we describe as a critical period for social reward learning.
And critical period, when I've heard you talk about this, it's connected to sort of that notion of imprinting. When certain types of birds, like maybe migratory birds or birds that leave the mother very early, hatch, that they attach to the first thing that they encounter. Whether it could be a human being, it could be another animal, it could even be another inanimate object. Is that the kind of sort of simplistic notion of the critical period that's relevant here?
Absolutely. In fact, that imprinting behavior in snow geese was the first behavior that Konrad Lorenz, back in 1935, described and coined the phrase critical period to describe. And what he was referring to is that long-lasting attachment that you're describing, that happens, but only within the first 48 hours after hatching. After that, they don't form that long-lasting attachment, that whatever's in their environment that they've attached to ceases to be relevant in the same way and ceases to be a salient signal that allows them to form a long-lasting attachment. And so that window of time where the animal is much more sensitive to their environment and able to form these long-lasting memories, Konrad Lorenz called a critical period. And he did that in 1935. But since then, there have been lots and lots of critical periods that have been described. I think most people are familiar in their own lives with the critical period for language learning. So if you've ever tried to learn a language later on in life, it's much harder to learn. You have to practice. You have to study. You will always have an accent when you speak it. You won't speak it with the same sort of fluidity and ease as you did your native language. My sister seems to be the exception to this rule because she doesn't seem to have a critical period for languages. She speaks like 5 or 6 fluently and a couple more just as needed basis. But for most people, you know, the language that you learned as a child is the one that you know and the one that you speak fluidly without an accent. And anything else later on is much harder and not as fluid. And so that is reflecting the fact that there's a critical period for language learning, but there are other critical periods as well. So there are critical periods for organizing the visual system, for organizing the touch system, and probably clinically the one that we are sort of most fascinated by and will follow up with is that there's a critical period for recovering motor function after you have a stroke. So right after you have a stroke, you have this short window of time. 6 weeks seems to be the sort of sweet spot where if you do intensive physical therapy, that's where you're going to get the most recovery. But after that window is closed, you know, you're not going to get much more motor recovery after that window is closed.
Mm-hmm. So now your focus was on social reward learning aspects of critical period. So is that a relatively newer concept or also one that goes back a while?
Yeah, no. So we discovered the social reward learning critical period, mm-hmm. and we were able to discover it because we were able to do this in animal studies. So we were able to look at 15 different ages. We were able to look at both sexes. It was hundreds and hundreds of mice and really characterized the developmental timeline. But that being said, you know, people who do human cognition studies and child development studies had already sort of had an inkling that something like this must exist just by doing comparisons between two different ages and the ways that children process social information. There was an idea out there that it might exist, but it wasn't formally demonstrated until we showed it in mice.
I see. And when you're administering the MDMA to the mice, does it make a difference whether these mice are the equivalent of juveniles or adolescents or adults?
Yeah. So when we were trying to characterize the behavioral critical period, we also did some studies to try and understand what are the cellular and synaptic mechanisms underlying that establishment and constraining of that learning and memory to this window. And we had implicated oxytocin that we talked about before in that process. And we thought, well, we want to be able to reopen this critical period because neuroscientists, pretty much since we first knew about critical periods, have had the intuition that the ability to reopen critical periods is going to be immensely powerful as a therapeutic. But oxytocin doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier. So you might have heard in the lay press people talking about intranasal oxytocin, but honestly, that just doesn't really work that well. It doesn't get into the brain. Whatever effects people are reporting of intranasal oxytocin are probably indirect effects on the brain and effects that that oxytocin is having in the body, not in the brain. And so we thought, well, gosh, you know, is there some other way that we might be able to trigger this reopening of the critical period? And we knew that MDMA had these pro-social effects, and MDMA, there was some anecdotal evidence that it might also be triggering oxytocin release in the central nervous system. And so what we did is, unlike the octopus experiments and other experiments that had been done before, is we gave the MDMA in adult animals. So remember, at the adult age, the critical period is closed. So we gave the MDMA and then we just waited for 48 hours for all of the acute MDMA to wash out of the system. And then we measured social reward learning again in the adult animals. And what we found is that 48 hours after we gave the MDMA, that juvenile ability, that ability to learn from the social environment, came back in the adults. And that restoration of the juvenile behavior in adulthood, we thought was very strong evidence that what we'd done is reopened this critical period. And then at the same time, if we gave MDMA to the juvenile animals, it had no impact on the magnitude of social reward learning. So it wasn't just that the adult animals are sort of satiated and that we just drained the emotional bucket and made them thirsty for social again, because if that was the case, then we would have expected that depriving the animals in juveniles would also restore an increased level of social reward learning, and it didn't. And so taken together, those two things really convinced us that what we're looking at is a reopening of a critical period, not some sort of satiation with sociality.
Right. And you saw this reopening, though, in the adult mice that were in social situations, but not the ones that had been isolated?
Right. So that is a really interesting component of this study, which I think lends further support to the idea that critical period reopening is what really accounts for the incredible therapeutic effects that we're seeing with these drugs. So one of the things that I think probably your audience will be familiar with is that psychedelics in particular have this feature of being set and setting dependent, right? So if you're around people that you feel comfortable with or giving off good vibes, if you will, then the MDMA experience can be very different than if you're feeling threatened or anxious or not safe. And that phenomenology of the set and setting dependence of psychedelic drugs also translates to the therapeutic effects, right? So you can't just take MDMA and go to a rave and expect that your PTSD is going to be cured. You really want to pair the MDMA with the context of psychoanalysis to look at the trauma that you are trying to deal with and then rewriting those memories around the trauma during the trip and we think actually afterwards as well. And this context dependence or, you know, the set and setting, but we call it context dependence of psychedelics effects, we think are different than, for example, MDMA has like a mild social anxiolytic property. Psilocybin and LSD and ketamine have antidepressive properties, but those antidepressive and anxiolytic properties of the drugs don't seem to be context dependent, right? And so these drugs do a lot of different things in the brain. Some of the properties are context dependent and some of them are not. And we think that the exciting possibility is that the remarkable sort of this is going to be a cure for neuropsychiatric disease. Part of these drugs comes from that context dependence. And so we were really excited that unlike other studies which had looked at the antidepressive properties or the anxiolytic properties and shown that these were not context dependent, critical period reopening is context dependent. So you can only reopen the social critical period if you give MDMA in the social context. And we think that the social part of that is a little bit of a, we have more evidence now suggesting that that's a little bit of a red herring because we are excited about the possibility that psychedelics are the master key for unlocking critical periods across the brain, sort of writ large. And if that's true, then we would expect that the dependence on the social context is true because we're trying to open a social critical period. But if we were trying to open a visual critical period or a motor learning critical period, then visual experience or motor experience during the acute phase of the psychedelic would be the important context, not social.
Now, when you found that what you were finding with MDMA was also true with a variety of psychedelics, was that surprising to you?
Yeah, so that work isn't published yet, but I'm happy to briefly mention it. We basically did those experiments as a control. I was fairly certain that the reason the MDMA was having this remarkable ability to reopen the critical period was because it's so pro-social in quality, right? Its acute subjective effects are really pro-social. But, you know, nobody's taking LSD and doing a cuddle puddle. In fact, most people need to kind of, especially if they're having an inner-directed trip, you know, they need quiet and maybe one or two other people, but they're not cuddling the way they are with MDMA. And so we were really surprised when LSD and psilocybin and ketamine and ibogaine all also reopened this critical period. And what that suggested immediately to us, and this is what we're following up in the subsequent studies, is that the acute subjective character of psychedelics really isn't the thing. So the thing that makes them all similar is their ability to open the critical period. And in fact, that the thing that they share in common, and which is why I call all of them psychedelics, is that they all induce an altered state of consciousness, right? And it's hard to define exactly what that means, that altered state of consciousness, but all of the psychedelics, whether they're dissociative, hallucinogenic, empathogenic, or onirogenic, they all have that property of inducing that altered state of consciousness. And so our recent studies really suggest that maybe what it feels like to be in an altered state of consciousness is just what it feels like to open critical periods. Hmm.
But now you're probably using that phrase altered state of consciousness in a narrower sense, because even the name of this podcast, right, psychoactive, which essentially implies altered state of consciousness. And we think about that applying really to almost all psychoactive substances. So not just the psychedelics, but cocaine or opioids, or for that matter, it could be caffeine or nicotine or, you know, any range of others in sufficient doses. So what about those other substances? I mean, they are altering consciousness. Is it just that they're altering it in a different way or different degree?
Yeah, so I guess I would quibble with the idea that they're all altering consciousness. They're all altering brain function, I guess. And so I guess it sort of depends on how broadly you want to define consciousness. If you want to define it really broadly and you want to say consciousness is just in the sense of conscious versus unconscious, then every anesthetic is also a psychoactive. But when people say the altered state of consciousness induced by psychedelics, I think they're referring to a very narrow sense of what it means to be conscious. Again, it's a little bit hard to define. I mean, I feel like philosophers have written whole books about what is the interesting sense of the word consciousness. And so I don't really want to spend too much time on that. But what I will say is that the shared ability of psychedelics to alter the sense of consciousness that's different from other psychoactive drugs like cocaine and nicotine and alcohol and even marijuana seems to be related to their therapeutic effects, right? Because it's not like people are curing drug addiction with cocaine. It's not like people are curing PTSD with cocaine, right? In fact, cocaine's psychotropic or psychoactive effects are more likely to lead to abuse and addiction-like behaviors. They incidentally take a reward and make it context independent. And they're really what I would call drugs that induce, cocaine in particular, induce hyperplasticity. And so by plasticity, what I mean is that synapses in the brain, which are the connections between neurons and how they communicate with each other, the weights that are assigned to each of those synapses change as you encode memories. And we think that that plasticity of the synaptic weights is what's responsible for encoding memories. And what cocaine seems to do is massively increase the number of synapses and dendritic sprouting and create a whole bunch of extra memories that are around using cocaine, enjoying cocaine, associating every positive feeling you've ever had with cocaine. And that sort of hyperplastic response is very different from what we see with psychedelics.
Well, let me ask you this, Gul. I mean, because let me just throw in two other drugs here that kind of fall in between. I mean, obviously, MDMA is amphetamine-based. And so one question is, what about other types of amphetamine? They share some things in common with cocaine, some things in common with MDMA. And the other one is, what about THC, which kind of falls in between the kind of altered, in fact, many people say it does create altered state of consciousness in ways that sometimes can resemble the psychedelics. So what about those two, amphetamine and THC?
Yeah, so we haven't actually tested either one directly, but I suspect that amphetamine is going to look very much like cocaine, which, you know, cocaine does not reopen the critical period, but it does induce these addiction-like behaviors and addiction-like changes in synapses. THC is definitely a strange one, and it's an in-between case, and we really don't know. And one of the things about THC that I've always been sort of fascinated about is that it seems to be a great imitator. So if you've, you know, mostly been intoxicated with alcohol and then you start doing THC, you know, your high, your THC high is sort of mellow. But after you do THC, after you've tried any of the psychedelics, then suddenly it can take on a sort of psychedelic character. And I don't have any clue about what that's about. The reason that we sort of didn't focus on THC in our experiments is that THC, especially at very high doses, seems to induce a certain amount of paranoia in people. And we actually think we have a hypothesis about why that is, but you'll have to invite me again for a different podcast to talk about that one.
Okay. Well, so let's just talk about some of the other implications implications of the study. So you find that, you know, it's working. And obviously, you know, MDMA, you know, is sort of an empathogen, heartwarming, cuddly, whereas we think about the psychedelics. And sometimes, I guess, one of the theories is that the intensity of the sort of spiritual or mystical experience is part of what is associated with their efficacy. But one of the other things that I saw you pointing out is that, you know, I've typically thought about you do MDMA, you do psychedelics, and then you have a psychotherapeutic, you work with a therapist immediately thereafter. But you're pointing out that this critical period that gets opened, it's not just for a few hours or something. It can be quite a bit longer. And that the longer the drug experience lasts, maybe the longer the critical period less. And so just talk about that and the implications of that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I mentioned that we were beginning to have some evidence that what it feels like to be in this psychedelic altered state of consciousness is just what it feels like to reopen critical periods. And part of the evidence we have for that is this proportionality between how long the acute subjective effects of psychedelics last and how long the critical period stays open after the psychedelic acute effects have worn off. And so just to compare the different drugs, so ketamine, you know, most people's acute effects of ketamine last anywhere from 30 minutes to maximum sort of 2 hours. Whereas people who take LSD, you know, it's 8 to 10 hours is the typical acute subjective effects last. Whereas Ibogaine lasts for a really long time. So between 36 and 72 hour long acute subjective effects of Ibogaine. And just like that, what we see is that ketamine keeps the critical period open for 48 hours. Psilocybin and MDMA seem to keep it open for about 2 weeks after we give the drug, LSD for 3 weeks, and Ibogaine, you know, we haven't found the outer limit of it, but at least a month after we give Ibogaine, the critical period stays open. And so that has, I think, three really important implications. One is that, as I said, it sort of lends further support to the idea that critical period reopening is the thing that makes this class of drugs a single drug class, the shared property across the drugs. The second one is that I think when we're designing clinical trials for using these drugs to cure PTSD, we're going to want to be really, really careful about making sure that we offer enough support to people after the acute subjective effects have worn off, because what's 2 weeks in a mouse could be 2 months in a human, right? And what we think this is analogous to is putting a person back into the sort of vulnerable and sensitive state, just like a child. And so we want to offer support to those people. And, you know, I would very much like to get funding to run a clinical trial that looks at the difference between people who were given sort of standard of care, the way the FDA wanted the trials to be designed, and another group where instead of just going home and writing in your journal and calling into the therapist for the weeks after, you get to go to something like a retreat and you are given the sort of space and support and therapy that you need to continue to integrate those memories and those traumatic habits that you've developed from your being traumatized, that you reintegrate them into your new personality habits and traits and your new world in that sort of safe space. So that's the second implication. And then the third implication, and this sort of touches on what you mentioned about Roland Griffith's studies about the depth of the mystical experience. I think that what this is telling us is that there is a lot of enthusiasm right now, especially from the business world, to rush to develop psychedelics that don't have any kind of psychedelic side effects, if you will. So engineer out the mystical experience, the big trip, right? And I suspect that those efforts will all take miracle drugs like LSD and psilocybin and Ibogaine, which have these very profound ability to change memories and potentially cure things like heroin addiction, and essentially engineer them back down to being something like an SSRI. Because I think if you get rid of that long experience, you're going to interfere with the mechanism that is reopening critical periods.
So when you're talking about this extended length of the critical period, it's not just about being cautious about how therapists deal with that period and being aware that it's not just about the hours and days afterward, but you're also talking that there's actually this bonus that maybe people didn't realize, that there's this extended period of time in which the insights can be almost harvested and developed even more thoroughly, more deeply.
Absolutely, absolutely. And in fact, I think that this is why for really, really entrenched memories and really hardcore addictions like heroin addiction, the big sort of anecdotal stories that we hear about recovery from heroin addiction are all coming from Ibogaine, right? Not from ketamine or psilocybin, right? Because those memories are really entrenched into the fabric or the whole sort of network of memories and habits and patterns and personality traits that a human has developed over their lifetime. And to undo them, you probably need to have the critical period stay open for a long time so that you can say, okay, oh, I'm going to the park and normally I would have a heroin craving here, but you know what? I don't need that anymore. You know, rewriting those memories around the whole circuit of memories that surround that very entrenched addiction.
Now, are there implications, I mean, for example, about, say, multi-dosing, like giving ketamine 5 or 6 days in a row or administering multiple doses of MDMA or psilocybin LSD over a period of days or weeks? Anything you can say about that stuff? Will we see added benefits, reduced benefits?
Yeah. So honestly, when we first started these experiments, I basically had the intuition that, you know, the longer you can keep it open, the better, and that would help you to have the most access to those sort of calcified memories, if you will. But I'm beginning to think that actually there probably is an opportunity to stagger them, especially because you sort of hinted at this in the question, especially the serotonin psychedelics seem to have this property of causing desensitization or tolerance very quickly. So people who do microdosing of psilocybin, you know, not everybody has the same experience, but a lot of people will report that very quickly the effects of the drug seems to attenuate, right? And so what we have also discovered is that we've kind of a little bit taken down the primacy of the serotonin 2A receptor, because while psilocybin and LSD obviously really, you know, we have to activate the serotonin 2A receptor in order to get these critical period reopening. Ketamine, MDMA, and ibogaine don't care about the serotonin receptor. In fact, there's evidence that ketamine is working through a different receptor called NMDA. Ibogaine is probably working through the kappa opioid receptor. MDMA, it's not clear. It's causing a, you know, release of serotonin, and it's probably binding to all 14 of the serotonin receptors, not just 2A. And it doesn't require 2A to reopen. And so it might be that, you know, to stagger not only drugs that have different durations of critical periods. So, for example, if you want to on-ramp somebody who's had a very, very serious, horrible, maybe complex PTSD and facing the traumatic memories all at once is too much for them. So maybe we want to start gently with them with some, I'm just making this up, but this is what our newer data is starting to suggest, that we want to start looking at the possibility of combining maybe some short acting, some microdoses, some ketamines early on just to loosen things up. And then as the patient gets more comfortable, kind of do the longer trips that go deeper and then sort of stagger on top of that, the big, big trip at the end. And that could potentially allow us to mix and match so that we can do the most work over a long period of time, but also give people breaks and also give people an opportunity to wade in if they're not ready to be kind of thrown out the end of the pool.
Let's take a break here and go to an ad.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. I'm Abby, a mother of two, and I had these battles myself. Endless excuses, delay tactics, and many tears and tantrums. But I've created a solution. The perfect kids podcast that makes bedtime a dream. It's called Koala Moon, and it's hosted by me, Abby. With over 300 episodes, packed with original stories and sleep meditations, Koala Moon makes bedtimes easy and enjoyable. Episodes start out engaging and really rather magical, but As they progress, they gently slow to a calm and relaxing pace to have your little ones out like a light. Since launching in 2022, Koala Moon has helped with over 20 million nights sleep and received over 6,000 five-star reviews. Win back your evenings. Listen to Koala Moon now on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What does optimism look like? I'm on a quest to find the people who inspire us to dream more and do more. I'm Simon Sinek, and I host a podcast called A Bit of Optimism. I talk to all sorts of people, from the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to a hairdresser on Instagram who gives out free haircuts to the homeless, from the CEOs of the world's largest companies to the comedy writer who visited the wreckage of the Titanic. I love talking to leaders, artists, authors, and eccentrics about life, leadership, purpose, mental fitness, human skills, high performance, and other curious things. It leaves me feeling wiser, more inspired, and, well, more optimistic. Because after all, this is a bit of optimism. The world is full of magic and wonder, if you know where to look for it. Listen to A Bit of Optimism on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Parents, ready to discover a new educational and interactive podcast for kids? Join Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids, where episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We learned how to recycle at the beach.
That was great fun. Cowie, what do you say?
It was. And that time when we did the science experiment and Billy made raisins dance.
That is so cool, Billy.
He did. Not to mention when a certain Elliot took up swimming classes with Lisa.
That was me.
Bet you can't catch me.
I'm going to get you.
All this fun and more in our Stories for Kids. Lingo Kids Stories for Kids is now available on Storybutton, the kid-friendly device for screenless podcast listening. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
My name is Ariel. I moved to the U.S. at 19. I spoke no English and I struggled finding job opportunities. Everything I have, I owe to the Adult Literacy Center and getting my high school diploma at age 22.
It was an honor helping you achieve your greatness. Now you're helping others achieve theirs. It inspires me.
When you graduate, they graduate. Find free and supportive adult education centers near you at finishyourdiploma.org. Brought to you by Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
Is there a limited number of times that one could use MDMA or these other drugs in order to open up this critical period? You know, listeners of this podcast will know on numerous episodes I've expressed my great sadness that MDMA, which was such a wonderful drug in my life when I was in my 30s and 40s, and mostly using it with my romantic partner or with a close set of friends, only a couple times in a rave setting, just doesn't really seem to work for me much in the last 10, 15 years. And I'm wondering, is there only so many times you can use MDMA or the others to open that critical period?
I mean, we don't really have hard data on that. What I will say is that I have an idea that there's going to be interactions between them. So for example, there's one clinical study in humans that shows that if you don't take people off their SSRI medication, so their Prozac or any of the drugs in that class, then the MDMA stops working. And that sort of makes sense because if the idea is that when you're blocking the serotonin transporter, MDMA actually has to sit in the same bonding pocket. So if the Prozac is in there blocking it away, then it's possible that that interferes with MDMA's ability to get into that same pocket and cause the same remarkable consequences. But what's more than that is that there's some older literature suggesting, not with SSRIs, but with older generation antidepressants like tricyclics and MAOIs, that what is happening, the reason that there's this delay between when you start taking the antidepressant and when you start to feel the effect is that the real effect of the drug might not be increasing the amount of serotonin that's available in the synapse itself, but that by increasing the basal levels floating around the neuron serotonin, that triggers in the cells that are normally receiving receiving the serotonin signal to pull in some of those serotonin receptors and sort of downregulate the number of receptors that are in the membrane. So sort of like if you've got a bunch of microphones out into an arena and everybody in the arena is screaming, maybe you pull a couple of those microphones in so that it's not so loud anymore. So that's kind of one early idea about how antidepressant drugs were working. And there is some suggestion that this could also be happening for LSD and psilocybin as well. So I could potentially formulate at least a hypothesis about why MDMA might stop working if you're also doing a lot of other psychedelics and or taking Prozac or any of these other antidepressant drugs, because they're sort of occluding each other's mechanisms, which is why I think it will be useful to develop an arsenal of drugs that are doing this with lots of different receptors, right? So maybe Ibogaine is going to help for somebody who has already kind of maximally tuned the serotonin receptors.
Mm-hmm. So is it a matter that does not one develop? I mean, even like I think in my case, I never did the antidepressants and I've been an occasional user of the psychedelics and MDMA for decades, but never a frequent user. I mean, is there an element in which one does develop a tolerance? Because just going back to that issue, if one's using this drug in the psychotherapy, right, in the proper setting in order to open up this critical period and deal with a past trauma as PTSD, or if one's talking about psilocybin and depression or whatever it might be, and you make some progress. But no, I mean, obviously, we sometimes see there's some research suggesting that when you do this, a one-off can provide a real cure, right? Not just a palliative, but a cure. Can there be value in or possibilities in terms of doing this 2 times, 5 times, 10 times, 20 times? Or is it kind of going to peak out? Like if it doesn't take the first time you do it, the second time, got to do something else.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are already trials where I think in Europe, MAPS is running some trials for complex PTSD, doing sort of multiple rounds of MDMA. But again, because of this issue of tolerance, again, it's going to be really important to understand the mechanism, because it's probably going to be the case that we're going to need to fine tune the dosing regimen so that we're not giving new MDMA before the critical period that we opened is already closed back up again, so that we can sort of maximally extend the amount of time that the person can do the psychotherapy work without running into tolerance issues from staggering them too close to each other. But again, also, this is going to be a case for trying to understand the mechanism, because one of the next follow-up questions that my lab is really pursuing is, okay, you know, we know that they're all working at different receptors. We have some hint that the next step, which is the biochemical signaling that comes after that, is also not the same for all of the different drugs. And so what's the next step? What's the thing? What's the last final common denominator that brings all of these psychedelics into the realm of being able to be these master keys for critical period reopening? And can we target that directly without melting the brain or causing seizures or causing a person to lose all of their memories? As we get a better handle on how these things are working, we can start to do a better job of designing trials with the drugs that we have, but then also learning from those mechanisms to know what are the limitations and what are the other things downstream that we could potentially boost to stop, for example, tolerance, or maybe reverse if the tolerance doesn't end up being part of the mechanism for how the drugs are curing. And I think that the tolerance issue really is probably going to be more relevant to the non-context dependent antidepressive properties of these drugs, which are going to be separate from critical period opening. And I think that critical period reopening is going to end up being the explanation for these cures, whereas the antidepressive properties are going to be more about the palliatives. And we can already see that a little bit in the clinical trials. So if we compare the way that the New England Journal of Medicine psilocybin versus SSRI for depression trial went, you know, basically they used the psilocybin the same way that we give Prozac, right? And so they were given the drug, monitored for, you know, bad side effects, but psychotherapy wasn't, you know, a big component of it. And what they saw is that the effects of psilocybin on depression were very similar to SSRI. Not worse, but not dramatically better either. Whereas the MAPS trial that was published in Nature Medicine last year, that one, you know, the whole approach was this is an adjunct therapy and the context is psychotherapy. And in that case, even though we still have issues around controls and direct comparisons, the ability to cure the PTSD compared to SSRIs or compared to just psychotherapy alone seems to be remarkably improved.
Mm-hmm. So, Ghul, at your lab at Johns Hopkins, you have a project called FATHOM, P-H-A-T-H-O-M. So what does that stand for? And what's it about? What are you trying to accomplish there beyond what the research you've described so far?
Yeah, so that stands for Psychedelic Healing, Adjunct Therapy Harnessing Opened Malleability. I came up with that in a dream, and I loved it because I love this idea that when people have really great MDMA experiences, they call it oceanic boundlessness. And I love the fathom as like a metaphor for that oceanic boundlessness. And basically, we're taking the unfathomable, which is cures for some of these brain diseases, and making them fathomable again. You know, that's sort of the dream that we are hoping. So the FATHOM project is really just our intuition that based on the fact that all of the psychedelics, whether they're empathogenic or not, are reopening the critical period, that these are the master keys for unlocking all critical periods. And if that's true, then the number of brain disorders and even probably non-brain disorders. So I have an idea about curing allergy and curing stutter and curing stroke would be remarkably increased if it's true that these are the master key for unlocking critical periods that neuroscientists have been looking for almost 100 years. And the project is really everything from the basic research that we are doing to try and convince ourselves that they are, in fact, the master key, all the way up to human clinical trials for stroke that we are getting, we're revving up to do, and potentially in the future, looking at what other ways that we can understand the brain using psychedelics.
So with stroke, for example, obviously with MDMA, one's talking about psychotherapy. With strokes, one's talking about physical therapy and reopening that critical period. And do you imagine that somebody who's subject to a stroke and gets partially paralyzed, that they would be able to go through these sessions? I mean, maybe not just one, but to do them 2, 3, 4 times a year to keep returning to that critical period with a physical therapist and delving more deeply into it?
Absolutely. So that's the dream. Basically, what we think is that most people who have a stroke now get some physical therapy, but it's not the sort of intensive motor practice that they need to get full recovery. And so most people get partial recovery. They compensate, you know, they learn how to button their pants with the other hand. They learn how to use their whole hand instead of their fingers to manipulate objects. But, you know, what we want is full recovery of normal levels of motion. But this is just for motor strokes, but, you know, all strokes. And the idea is that if we can pair the psychedelic, and the way we're imagining it right now is that the optimal way to pair it is not to pair it to practicing the specific motion that you are trying to get back. So like reaching for your cup or something, but that we should pair it with some sort of video game so that you are taking full advantage of the fact that psychedelics seem to put people into this mode of play-like behavior or non-goal-directed behavior, and that practicing motor in that sort of non-goal-directed manner paired with psychedelics should maximally restore the old ways of learning motor behaviors that you had from when you were a child, and that that will help restore more function after the stroke critical period has closed.
And could you imagine virtual reality types of machinery also playing a role in this stuff?
Yeah. So our collaborators on this project are Steve Zeiler and John Krakauer, and they have been developing not exactly virtual reality, but a video game that they can manipulate. The patient manipulates their arm and a dolphin on the screen kind of swims around. And we love that interactive video game aspect of it, that they could play while they were on psychedelics and for several days after the acute effects have worn off, continue to practice with that to kind of trigger the right kinds of memories. Uh-huh. So that's exactly the idea that we are pursuing.
Fascinating. I mean, I read that, you know, years ago, your interest, and maybe still, you had a strong interest in autism. And I guess with autism, there was for quite a while, maybe still, the notion that it's grounded in some sort of chemical imbalance. But how do you see this work relating to autism and trying to help people with that?
Yeah. So when I was a graduate student, you know, my thesis was something called the MGLUR theory of Fragile X and autism. And it was basically testing this idea that what causes most of the impairment that we see in Fragile X, which is a subtype of autism, are really an imbalance of this signaling that happens through another type of receptor called the MGLUR and the protein that's missing in Fragile X. And we were very excited. We know we did all these studies in animals, and then we were able to show that if we turn down the MGLUR signaling, then we could restore normal function in a bunch of different domains in mice. And we did those studies, and then 26 other preclinical labs replicated those findings, and all of the big drug companies got so excited. They were like, this is it. We've got the mechanism. Hundreds of millions of dollars were invested in clinical trials. And to the disappointment of the whole field, those clinical trials did not show clinically relevant improvements in human patients with autism. And I think that some of the people after those trials sort of dismissed them and said, well, you know, a mouse isn't a human and that's why they didn't work. But the authors themselves of the clinical trial studies wrote a follow-up paper sort of discussing, you know, what they thought might have happened and what might be some future directions. And one of the things that they mentioned is that all of the preclinical studies, all of the mouse studies were done very early in development. So either from genesis in the case of genetic manipulations or even just the pharmacological manipulations all happen in juvenile animals before a critical period for social reward learning would be closed. And granted, these studies were done before we had discovered this critical period. So I'm not, you know, pointing fingers or anything. But to me, that's very interesting because what it suggests is that maybe what we need to do with autism is go back and test that biochemical imbalance idea. But in this time, instead of giving the drug by itself, we pair it with reopening of the social critical period. And under those conditions of restoring the imbalance in the open state of the critical period will allow patients to learn from their social environment in the way that they missed out on early in development.
Wow. So do you actually have a study underway trying to look at opening up the critical period with people with autism?
We are starting in animals because I want to move carefully on this because one of the things that we know about autism is that the autistic mice do seem to have there's some indication that their critical periods don't close normally and that they have hyperplasticity. Before we'd be willing to jump into human clinical trials for that, I would want to make sure that A, it works in mice, but also that it's safe, right? Because especially with schizophrenia and autism, there's been a lot of very well-justified hesitation to jump in with psychedelics in case there's overlap between what causes autism and the same mechanisms that the psychedelics are triggering. But I also want to just say that while this sounds like I'm making one big rosy blanket, I also just want to caution that these are very powerful drugs, right? They have incredible potential, but if we don't understand how long they're lasting and what the impacts of the context are on our ability to change things, then I think they can be dangerous and used for ill by bad actors as well. I'm sure you've heard this analogy before, but of course we know that Charles Manson was giving members of his group LSD and indoctrinating them into his family. And this is not surprising to me as I think about how easy it is to manipulate children, how important it is to safeguard children from being exposed to certain kinds of things. And if we're really returning people to this childlike state of vulnerability, we also want to make sure that we protect ourselves from exposing ourselves to the wrong kinds of people.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, that definitely makes sense. I think you're exactly right in terms of the negative possibilities in terms of cults and all this sort of stuff. So, Gul, I typically ask my guests how and why they got into this line of work. And I've read that, you know, you come, both your parents were doctors and you come from a family full of doctors and scientists. But what can you share with us about your own use of psychedelics and how it may have impacted the ways you think about the research you're doing now?
Yeah, as a scientist, I'm a little bit hesitant to talk about any of this kind of thing. But I will just say that I think you would find that a larger percentage of neuroscientists than you might imagine first became interested in studying the brain because of psychedelics. And so I can tell you that my interest in this subject really started with a class that I took in college. My professor was Cynthia Kuhn, and she taught this class called Drugs, Brain, and Behavior. And about half of the class were, you know, psychonauts who just wanted to know what they were putting in their bodies. And the other half were sort of eager beaver medical students who wanted to get, you know, a leg up on pharmacology. And when I saw the serotonin molecule picture right next to the LSD molecule, I had sort of an epiphany that this was going to be the way that we were going to be able to answer the hard problems of neuroscience. What is consciousness? How is it that we know the world? What exists in the world? The sort of metaphysical problems that I think most neuroscientists start out with and eventually give up on because they realize that they're very hard and we're never going to be able to have sort of mechanistic detail on them. In that moment in that class, I had the idea that psychedelics would really be the tool to help us answer those big questions. And I continue to feel that, although I'm really excited that now seems to be the time to be able to do it. Because I think when I was an undergrad, we were still very much in the middle of the war on drugs. And I mean, obviously your listeners know a lot about that. But this shift that we've seen, even in the last 3 or 4 years, it's not complete yet. I mean, I'm still struggling to get funding from the NIH for this kind of research, because even though the higher ups are saying, yes, we're interested, there's still a lot of minds that need to be changed to see their potential. But for me, beyond the clinical aspects of it, I really am still incredibly motivated by the opportunity I see to use these as tools for discovering answers to the big questions like consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Right. And when it comes to your reticence about talking about whether or how, what you might have done, is part of that about needing government funding, or part of it about fear about the climate shifting, or part of it that you're not yet a senior professor with a big chair and all this sort of stuff? What holds you back in that?
I mean, I think it's a little bit of all of those things, but also people often tend to think of science as a metaphysics, you know, a certain, this is what's in the world, right? And I don't think of science that way. I think science is an epistemology. In other words, science is, how do we learn the world? What are the methods we use for discovering what is and isn't in the world? And there is an older scientific tradition where it was acceptable to know the world through direct personal experience. I mean, there have been Nobel Prizes won for that kind of N equals one science, right? But especially in neuroscience, that is not something that is necessarily thought to be good science. And especially this might be true with psychedelics, because they do have this noetic property of, you know, when you take them, you have this sense that like, oh, okay, now I really, really know. Like, everything I knew before is not as true as what I know now because of the psychedelics. And I think this leads some people to narcissism. In science, I think it has the potential to lead to sort of confirmation bias. And so, you know, at least in my own research, I have been very, very careful and nervous to over extrapolate personal experiences to the research, because I think especially with psychedelics, confirmation bias is a real problem. Mm-hmm. I can't say that I've fully succeeded in that, because Nevertheless, it's something I worry about.
Well, Glo, I've just learned so much from our conversation, and as well as preparing for our conversation. Thanks so much for joining me on Psychoactive. I think it's only a matter of short time before you're going to be another one of those big shots in psychedelic studies with your own chair, and you already have your huge program. You're already making quite a name for yourself. But this is fascinating. I really am curious to see where your research goes into other areas. So thanks so much for joining me on Psychoactive.
My pleasure, and thank you very much for having me.
If you're enjoying Psychoactive, please tell your friends about it. Or you can write us a review at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. We love to hear from our listeners. If you'd like to share your own stories, comments, and ideas, then leave us a message at 1-833-779-2460. That's 833-PSYCHO-0. Or you can email us at psychoactive@protozoa.com or find me on Twitter at Ethan Nadelman. You can also find contact information in our show notes. Psychoactive is a production of iHeartRadio and Protozoa Pictures. It's hosted by me, Ethan Nadelman. It's produced by Noam Osband and Josh Thane. The executive producers are Dylan Golden, Ari Handel, Elizabeth Giesis, and Darren Aronofsky from Protozoa Pictures, Alex Williams and Matt Frederick from iHeartRadio, and me, Ethan Nadelman. Our music is by Ari Belusian, and a special thanks to Avivit Bar-Yosef, Bianca Grimshaw, and Robert Beebe. Next week, I'll be talking with Paul Armentano, Normal's longtime deputy director, about marijuana and driving.
If we didn't have that linear correlation, we wouldn't have per se levels for alcohol. In fact, per se levels for alcohol only date back about 40 or 50 years. The reason we don't have these levels for cannabis or opioids or a number of other drugs that we know impact driving performance is because there is no linear correlation.
Subscribe to Psychoactive now so you don't miss it.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
Health Aid kombucha.
Parents, if you've ever experienced bedtime battles with the kids, I'm going to let you into a little secret. The Koala Moon podcast has revolutionized over 20 million bedtimes, with parents like you calling it life-changing and the perfect nighttime routine. With original kids' bedtime stories and cozy sleep meditations, every episode has been specially designed to make bedtimes a dream. Listen to Koala Moon on the iHeartRadio app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Discover a new educational and interactive podcast, Stories for Kids by Lingo Kids. Our episodes are packed with fun activities. Right, Elliot?
Oh, yes! We went shape hunting around the block, and we found spheres and cubes on the street.
That was great fun. Join Stories for Kids, the Lingo Kids podcast, inspiring you to learn while having fun. Listen to Stories for Kids on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The world is full of magic and wonder, if you know where to look. And I'm obsessed with looking for it. I'm Simon Sinek, and I host a podcast called A Bit of Optimism. Each week, I have a short conversation with someone who inspires me or teaches me something about life, leadership, and other curious things. I hope you'll join me on the journey. Listen to A Bit of Optimism on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.